Hi, everybody. We're here today with Sarge Goodchild, who is a practitioner of neurodevelopmental movement. Hey, Sarge.
Hi, Charlotte. How are you? Thank you very much for having me on the show today. And thank you as well for all of the fantastic work that you're doing through Wellness Connect.
Well, thanks, Sarge.
You're connecting people with some really phenomenal practitioners and providing a service that I think is desperately needed. There are a ton of people out there who have these very challenging health conditions and have no idea how to go about finding a person who's really literate in whatever they're facing.
Yeah.
And having you as a resource, being able to boil what would probably take them years down into an hour to help them get connected with the right person, I think it's an amazing thing that you're doing, and I'm proud to be a part of Wellness Connect. So thank you,
Sarge. It's awesome. And unexpected. I didn't ask him to say that. So Sarge, tell us a little bit about your background and how you came to be a practitioner of the neurodevelopmental movement and what that means.
So I have been a practitioner of neurodevelopmental movement for over 25 years now. I got into the business because of my own personal experience with neurodevelopmental movement. As a child, I experienced an anoxic brain injury. So I had I was cut off from oxygen for a period of time during childbirth. I had the umbilical cord wrapped around my neck. It was a difficult birth. I am the first of three kids, and my mother had had several miscarriages before she became pregnant with me, so she was ecstatic to have to give birth to me, but she was also immediately concerned because I was somewhat blue and I was a bit floppy. But this was back in the late 60s. I was born in 1969, and we didn't have the sort of technology that we do today. So when my mother asked her medical team whether or not I would be okay, their best answer was, we won't be able to tell you until he's about 4 or 5 years old. By the time I was four, I was having seizures, but they were incorrectly diagnosed as immature startle reflex by my local pediatrician. But by the time I was four, I then had a one-year-old sister. And my one-year-old sister became a comparative basis for my parents. So they could look and see everything that my sister had accomplished by one that I was really still struggling with or hadn't done at the age of four. So they started taking me in to Children's Hospital, which is where I got diagnosed with severe epilepsy. Before I got diagnosed with epilepsy, I was diagnosed as learning disabled. Mm-hmm. And it was suggested that I be put in an early education setting. That happened to be a Montessori school. And in order to get in, I had to be brought up to speed on all my vaccines. My mother always claimed that the MMR vaccine likely saved my life. And when I questioned her about that as to why, she said, well, because after you got that vaccine, you didn't produce saliva for 9 months. So that's a vaccine injury right there. It also happens to be chronologically at the same time where that immature startle reflex that I'd been diagnosed with became the severest form of epilepsy that many doctors at Children's Hospital in Boston had ever seen in their careers. So from the time I was about 5 years old until I was 10 years old, I was put on a protocol of heavy amounts of anticonvulsant medications and things like Benadryl and Valium, phenobarbital, Mebrol, Klonopin, et cetera, to try to stop my seizures. And there were only two things that resulted from all of those medications that I was on. One is I never experienced seizure control at any time. Mm-hmm. I was still having tons of grand mal and tons of petit mal. And two, I was subsequently diagnosed with things like autism and cerebral palsy and mental retardation. I was considered uneducable, mentally retarded. I was put in the back of a classroom in a study carrel where I couldn't see the teacher or the blackboard in front of me. And I was left there to drool all over my paperwork. I was physically abused by the kids on the school ground, by the boys on the school ground, and mentally abused by the girls on the school ground. And basically felt like a burden to my teachers, who didn't exactly treat me exceptionally well either. And again, we're talking about
now. How old were you at this point? Yeah.
So we're talking about the 70s. So I was obviously in school by the time I was 5 or 6 in that mm-hmm. early education setting, yeah. trying to get me caught up. And then I was in the Nahant public school system for a number of years before ultimately going to Tower. So I began my program. I began this program of neurodevelopmental movement when I was 9 years old. It was just before my 9th birthday. Mm-hmm. My 9th birthday would have been in October, and I started the program in September. And so that period from 5 to 9, I was on enormous amounts of medication. My eyes were so swollen that I couldn't really open my eyes completely. And my gums were so engorged from all the toxicity of the medication that I used to have to routinely go into my dentist without pain meds, because the amount of anticonvulsants and other medications I was on, any additional medication would have put me at risk of being slipped into a medically induced coma. That's the level of medication that I was on. So without meds, he would take out a surgical thing and cut my gums back off my teeth. So my childhood was a remarkably difficult childhood. Mm-hmm.
Hey, Sarge, can I ask you a question? So sure. What did you say, so 5 to 9, right? Like, I can imagine you remember the pain of the dentist, and you can remember, like the children piece of the boys, beating you up and the girls not being kind. Like, what pieces are like the most, I guess not memorable isn't the word, but in your experience, like, cause those are like really, you're telling this story and you can tell my heart is just like, oh my God, this picturing you, you're this grown, really healthy man now, but what that felt like as a 5 to 9 year old, like those things that you've highlighted.
So I'll tell you the hard parts, Charlotte. The hard parts are not the pain. The hard parts have never been the pain for me. I have an extremely high pain tolerance because of my childhood. Those aren't the things that I recall. I can recall the blood more than I can recall the pain.
Yeah.
The things that are hard. So I had grand mal seizures. So that often meant falling down and hitting my head very hard. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, often it was near something that was generally hard. Yeah. So there was a doctor who lived up the street and around the corner from us who had a gurney set up on his sun porch for me. Mm-hmm. So whenever I needed to get stitches, usually in the head, yeah. I don't remember getting stitches anywhere else at that time in my life. But if I ever needed to get a couple of stitches in my head, he would just lay me out in the gurney and stitch me up right there. And I remember that gurney. I don't remember the pain. I don't remember anything else, but I remember that sun porch, and I remember that little bed or gurney or whatever it was that he had in his sun porch for me. And the thing that's probably the hardest for me is that the way that my parents learned of this program was because there was a little girl named Sarah. And Sarah had anoxic brain injury. She had drowned in the family pool. Mm-hmm. And they found her and were able to revive her when they surfaced her, but she had a very severe brain injury. Excuse me. My mother was one of the volunteers that was going to her house to put her through this neurodevelopmental movement routine as one of the volunteers. And she would come home And she would explain this to my father. My father's a successful commercial real estate broker. And so he was friends with lawyers and doctors and on business entrepreneurs and those sorts. He was not friendly with chiropractors and acupuncturists and massage therapists and herbalists. The stories that my mother was sharing around the dinner table were very, you know, they sounded almost impossible to him, but he's not a guy who leaps to judgment quickly. So he decided to take a day off from work and go with my mother and participate, be a volunteer for the same day that my mother was volunteering. And he walked into that room. This is always the hardest part of the story for me. He walked into that room and he saw what was being done for this little girl. And he talked to the other volunteers and validated all of these stories that my mother had been telling him. And when he left, he got into the car and he looked at my mother and he said, "Martha, what the hell are you doing?" And my mother looked at him and goes, "What do you mean? You just saw what I'm doing." And he goes, "Martha, this family has 70 volunteers. They don't need you. Sarge needs you." And so that is how I got started.
Yeah.
My father was the impetus to get me going on this program. Mm-hmm. My mother did all the hard work. My mother is primarily the one who recovered me. So I began that program at 9 years old by having been on an enormous amount of medications. By the time I was 10, so within a year, my mother had taken it upon herself to wean me off of every medication that I'd been taking. And I have never had a seizure since. Nor have I taken any medications. Maybe for a cold or a cough when I was in high school or college. But I haven't even taken a Tylenol or an Advil in 25 years.
That is incredible. And yeah. I'm just so appreciative just to say this to you that, I've heard that story. You and I have personally talked about it, but for you to share with the audience, I think is, thank you is, I guess, all I can say, because I think it's important for people to hear stories like your own, to understand that there is more than just hope, that there's someone out there that understands maybe what their family's going through, their child's going through, but also that you are there to help, you know, beyond the hope.
Well, I think one of the things that makes me different and one of the things that therefore makes active healing different is that having been through what I've been through and having worked for 25 years in this particular capacity, it's given me an understanding and a compassion for the human condition that I think is hard to find, especially with, you know, a traditional practitioner, you know, a mainstream medical doctor or something like that, doesn't necessarily have that history to draw from when he or she is working with a client. So, you know, I did not want to go into this work initially. I'll tell you that. I wanted to distance myself from it because when I came out the other side, 4 years in total, right? It took a year to get off of all the medications, but it took an additional 3 years to recover my kind of intellectual abilities and my physical skills. So I wanted to distance myself as far as I could from that past because it was such a difficult history. And so I went to college, and when I graduated, I was working for an advertising company. Mm-hmm. Before that, I'd worked for discount stock brokerage companies and landscapers, and I'd been the dock boy at Pickering Wharf at one point. So I had had a lot of different jobs. And, you know, I happened to get fired from the advertising job after my boss got fired. And I needed something to do that would take me through the winter. And I didn't want to shovel snow. And my mother was looking for help. And that was 25 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So over the course of that 25 years, I've been able to, you know, one of the things that we see in kids when you're talking about neurodevelopmental movement, right? What I'm doing with neurodevelopmental movement is I am leveraging the developmental milestones that should be part of a typical child's progression. You know, we learn how to roll over. We learn how to crawl on our stomachs in a military pattern. We get up on hands and knees. We begin to creep on hands and knees. Ultimately, we pull to a stand. We begin balancing. We begin walking, and then eventually hopping, skipping, and running, right? So each one of those different developmental stages is actually triggering growth in a very specific area of the brain. And so from a neurodevelopmental standpoint, what we're able to do is we're able to use those functions to assess the health of the brain. And once we understand where the brain is disorganized or dysfunctional, we can use those very same movements to develop health and integrity in that part of the brain. We do it in a developmentally appropriate way. So we start at the lowest stage and we begin working our way up. And it's all about securing a really healthy neurological foundation below the cortical level of the brain. Because once we get that stuff taken care of, then there we have this unbelievably diverse set of practitioners who can work on the cortical side. You know, whether it's a specialized school like Landmark, which is a local school that we have here that is phenomenal for kids with dyslexia, or we're working with someone specifically about a math disability, you know, like a place like Mathnasium.
So just to gain clarity for the audience, I'm moving sort of into the how you work. So let's maybe flip it for a second, because I think it might be helpful to do this, that you, let's talk about a typical client, give an example maybe of, you know, two different clients that you might see. One that might be more like your child with, you know, ADD or dyslexia, and then maybe your more extreme cases, like your own childhood experience. And I just want to go back to one other thing that I think I find really fascinating, and given, you know, where we are in the world right now, and just where we are in healthcare, to go back to what you said in your childhood of taking a year to get off meds, right? And what that did for your seizures, I think is something just that I want to reiterate, because it is, we live in a world where it's really easy to say, okay, let's, you know, take something to help us feel better, because that's what we've been trained to do in Western medicine. But in truth, to really, this is where I think the advocating, the educating, and navigating come in for people. Obviously, medications work in different ways and for different people. But to really be able to step back and have perspective, or use a professional like yourself, to have the perspective and the advocacy in ourselves to be like, to draw those connections, because oftentimes that isn't what people make a direct correlation to. So you were, you know, having this amazing share with us, so I didn't want to interrupt, but I really want to make sure that we go back to the piece of the audience really hearing and resonating that part about how medications can really negatively impact our bodies, and sometimes we aren't drawing the parallel. So just wanted to say that.
Right. I'll expand on that just very briefly. I'll say that, you know, when we work with a holistic practitioner, what we're looking to do is we're looking to support the body from the inside out to make sure that the body has all of the resources that it needs so that it can heal itself based on its priorities. When we work with an allopathic practitioner, we are forcing our priorities on the body and using a medication as a system of restraint.
Right, right? Treating symptoms.
Right, we're doing it from the outside in. We're using something from the outside to control the body, as opposed to putting something into the body like a nutrient that is going to allow the body a broader expression of its health.
Yeah, yeah. I just thought it was an interesting thing to go back to. So now maybe give the audience a glimmer of how you work with maybe two different clients and what that could look like.
So I work with a really broad spectrum of clients. So I work with kids who have severe and profound cerebral palsy. I work with kids with epilepsy, autism spectrum disorders, and I see quite a few kids with reactive attachment disorder, which is an attachment and bonding disorder. Most of those kids, not all, but most of those kids are adopted from third world orphanages where they've experienced institutional neglect and abuse. Mm-hmm. And their care has been given to them on a schedule basis as opposed to an as needed basis, which is an incredibly good way to disrupt a child's ability to bond mm-hmm. with anything at any point in the future.
Yeah.
And then I work with kids who have things like dyslexia and ADHD. So it's a very broad spectrum. And so we'll take a kid who has institutionalized trauma and has an attachment and bonding disorder. A lot of times these kids have actually been tied to their cribs. So they've had a wrist or an ankle that's literally been tied to the crib. And they've been restrained from being able to move through this developmental sequence the way that nature intended them to. And the consequence for that is that different areas of the brain have not been stimulated, as well as different parts of the anatomy. So you'll typically have really screwed up, you know, you'll have feet that are incredibly flat-footed, you'll have really tight heel cords, they will not have worn proper hip sockets, the curves in their back will be bad, they've been on their back, so their eyes will have what misalignments or what is technically called a strabismus. They haven't tactilely been given the stimulation that they need. So there's all sorts of issues that come into play. And what we're doing with neurological development, neurodevelopmental movement, is we are looking for the earliest stage that we can find where we feel there's been a break in that process.
Okay.
Whether it's learning how to roll over or crawl on their stomachs. And oftentimes that also looks at investigating primitive reflexes and seeing if there are reflexes that are getting in the way and understanding how a child sees and how they hear. So when we put together a program for a child, we're basically looking at seven different areas. We're looking at their vision. So we can assess, there are four parts of the brain that I'm concerned about when I do a neurodevelopmental assessment. We're looking at the medulla oblongata, the pons, all of the structures of the midbrain, which actually involve lots of different structures, and then the cortex. So we can look at we can take just one pathway. So we've got three pathways in and three pathways out. So we can look at your vision, your hearing, your sense of touch. Those are pathways into the brain. We do have taste and smell, but they're really hard to create a hierarchy in the brain as mm-hmm. far as what's going on. So we put those aside. So vision, hearing, and touch. And then on the output side, we have mobility, language, and hand function. We can look at those six functions as well as the seventh function of primitive reflexes. And we can begin to create a really good diagnostic trail of evidence that shows us where the brain is dysfunctional and where it needs support. And then we're going to leverage the developmental movement or the developmental stage that correlates with that specific area of the brain. And we're gonna do it intensely. Mm-hmm. So there's a law in economics that's Pareto's law of economics that says 80% of what we do only gives us 20% on our return of investment, right? Mm-hmm. Yet 20% of what we do gives us 80% return on our investment. We're going to take that law of economics and we're going to apply it to the child. We're going to say 20% of what a kid does during their development is like pick their nose or scratch their butt or annoy their sibling, right? And that only gives them 20% of their results. 20% of what they do is crawling on their stomach, creeping on hands and knees, going through these very specific developmental stages. If we start to focus a lot of our time and a lot of our energy on that 20%, then we set the stage for that child being able to catch up with their peers, right? Yeah. If we start spending 80% of our time working on that 20% of our skills, mm-hmm. then that child is, their nervous system is going to mature at a much faster rate. So the child whose nervous system has only been maturing at say 20 or maybe 40%, their peers are constantly getting further and further away from them, right? Because they're maturing at 100% of the rate.
Right.
Right? If we can take that child who's only been maturing at 40%, the rate of their typical peer, and we can get them maturing at 120%, then they're eventually going to catch their peers. And that is exactly what happened with me. We focused very intensely. I ran a very heavy duty program when I was young. But it allowed me to recover and be unrecognizable in terms of my skills from all of my peers in a 4-year period of time. I went from drooling on the paperwork in the back of the classroom to, you know, co-captaining some of the sports teams, being athletically, you know, I was never written up in any sports papers as being a phenomenal athlete, but I'm a good athlete.
Well, it's a miracle that you were able to play sports having been where you were. So right. Sarge, so you have sort of these, you see, it runs the gamut from the dyslexic ADD all the way to, you know, the more severe cases of autism, et cetera. Just to wrap up, how long, like, would you say, and again, it depends, I know, on the individual, but
how long does a program run?
Yeah, how long would a program run?
So I've got the fastest I've ever graduated a child from neurodevelopmental movement is 7 or 8 months. Mm-hmm. That is a remarkably quick program.
Yeah. And right? Is that daily? Is that?
That would be a lot of the kids who graduate in that amount of time are doing it 6 days a week.
Yeah.
I like my kids to have at least one day a week off. There are some parents who, if they give their kids that one day a week off, it totally breaks the schedule.
Yeah.
So I have quite a few parents who choose to do 7 days a week. Mm-hmm. But personally, I'm a fan of 1 or 2 days a week off, and they don't have to be consecutive.
Yeah. Yeah. Go ahead.
Most of my clients are in the program for a year to 18 months. But my severe kids are not, you know, my severely cerebral palsy kids are going to be working with me for years. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But the reason they work with me for years is because they're making progress with me that they can't match through traditional physical therapy.
Yeah.
And most of them are still getting traditional physical therapy or occupational therapy. I like to work as part of a team.
Team, yeah. I was going to say, I'm sure many of these kids need a team. I mean, there's a huge emotional component to it, all of it. Yeah. There's so much to talk about, and I'm so glad to have had you today. And I'm really appreciative for you to have shared your personal story too, because I think that's really important, obviously, part of your work, both personally and professionally, I'm sure. And lots more to talk about in the future.
Yeah, well, I very much appreciate your time, Charlotte. I also appreciate, again, all that you're doing through Wellness Connect. And I would love to come back on another show and talk about what we can do to put out the fire.
Yeah.
To put out all the inflammatory stuff and toxic stuff, which is the other half of my business.
Yeah,
but it's been a pleasure to talk about what will always remain the focus of active healing, which is these kids with learning disabilities and brain injuries and behavioral problems.
Sounds great. I'd love to do that. Let's talk soon. Thanks, Sarge.
Thank you, Charlotte.